This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello, I am Mark Balderstone, and welcome to The End of History, a monthly program presented by the Canterbury Socialist Society where we discuss the class struggle, contemporary unionism, economics and current affairs in order to promote working class history and socialist ideas as they apply to the 21st century.
Tēnā koutou katoa, nō mai haere mai ki The End of History, a radio show / podcast brought to you by the Canterbury Socialist Society. I'm Shannon Burns. I'm an executive member of the Canterbury Socialist Society, and it's my privilege to present this episode in which I chat with a special guest, play a couple of songs, review a couple of sources, and plug a couple of events. But first, a few words on the Canterbury Socialist Society. So the Canterbury Socialist Society, or the CSS, is a socialist organisation based in Ōtautahi, Christchurch, and affiliated to the Aotearoa New Zealand Federation of Socialist Societies. The CSS organises regular educational and social events, produces a biannual magazine titled Commonweal, supports the efforts of the working class in Ōtautahi, Christchurch and elsewhere, and more. As ever, you can visit socialistsocieties.org.nz to learn more about and join the CSS or a socialist organisation local to you. And you can also email canterburysocialistsociety@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, especially if you have feedback about or you would like to contribute to the end of history. Anyway, it's time now to introduce my special guest, Councillor Nico Wenera of the Wellington City Council. Nico was elected to Te Whanganui Ātara Māori Ward earlier this year, and as I understand it, Nico is also a member of the Wellington Socialist Society, I hope he won't mind me saying. Last week, I called Nico to discuss his role as a councillor, various issues relating to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and his concept of Indigenous socialism. It was a fantastic conversation, and I found myself thinking a lot about what Nico had to say. It also provided a really lovely reprieve from round two of COVID isolation. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here it is. Okay, so I guess maybe we just start. Nico, if you could introduce yourself to the listeners.
Sure. Tēnā koutou, ko Tainui te waka, ko Whikirea te manga, ko rau kawakawa te mana, ko Whuahia, Rahewa, ko Hongote, ngā marae, ko ngā torangatira, rātou ko Kaitahu, ko Ngāpuhi, ko Ngāti Pāhauwera, ngā iwi, ko te rau paraha te tutu te tutuna ariki, ko Nico Wenera, tōku ingoa. G'day, my name is Nico. I am a Wellingtonian. I am from Ngāti Torangatira primarily and a number of other iwi, as I mentioned. I've been living in the capital for most of my life, and aside from a brief stint overseas, Wellington and Kapiti have always been my homes. Last year, I was elected to the Wellington City Council in the Whanganui Ātara Māori Ward, and have been doing the job for about 3 months.
Amazing. So I've just been reading a little bit of your bio on the Wellington City Council website, and you seem like a person of many talents, lots to do with music, and also some really interesting stuff in there around sort of student activism and environmental activism. I wondered if you could just tell me about... I guess your journey in politics, have you always been a political person? Tell me about your life before you became a councillor.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I was probably doomed from the start because my dad was a treaty negotiator and my mum was a militant feminist back in the day. They were both really, really awesome. My father was negotiating the settlement from Ngāti Toa for many, many years, and we gained it sometime in the 2000s. And my mum has always been behind really awesome equality kaupapa and was a real role model for me growing up. I guess going to school and becoming politically aware was a slower process, but from there, once I went to university, I gained a little bit more political awareness. I spent some time as well when I was 18 living in Austria, in Vienna, and I was involved briefly with Klimjugend Wien, which is the sort of green alternative movement within the city of Vienna, and indeed all of Austria and a number of other countries. And I got a perspective on what, I guess, progressive politics looks like in Europe, because it's very different than in Oceania and indeed parts of the world. And coming back, I started my first year of university in what was a time of, I guess, Me Too and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I was learning more about Indigenous sovereignty movements and Indigenous socialism around the world, and finding out about, I guess, Marxism as a tool that historically oppressed groups have used to gain their own self-determination and free themselves from colonial overlords. And I guess what really catalyzed this journey into big boy politics, well, you can call local government that, was a friendship that I developed with Councillor Tamitha Paul, who is soon to be MP Tamitha Paul. She's honestly one of my heroes. When I was 18, it was sort of the rise of Chloe Swarbrick, and then when I got to university, it was the rise of Tam Paul. So I've had two really awesome young white men as my role models getting into politics. And she, after, you know, we went to a few protests together and kind of got stuck into local activism, she told me about the seat and she told me that I should give it a go. And I was pretty hesitant initially. I had suffered a nasty breakup. I had cut off all my hair and joined the army. And I kind of didn't really want to go back to politics.
Yep.
I enjoyed it being something that I did online, arguing with people. But she kept at me and she kept at me. And eventually I gave in. And here I am.
Amazing. I encountered Tamitha way back in the day. She wouldn't know who I am, but through like Thursdays and Black stuff, and she definitely seems like a very impressive woman. So,
Yep.
Cool. So that relationship was part of what motivated you maybe to stand for council. What is it about council specifically that, you know, you thought this is a good political route or this is a good role to go for? And maybe could you talk a little bit more about why you might have been hesitant or any reservations that you had?
Yeah, I mean, everything's fun until it's your job, right? I found this with music. I have occasionally found this with the defense force. And I am probably soon going to find it in politics. The shine hasn't quite worn off yet, but I'm sure it will. So there was that. You know, I enjoy being passionate about things. I enjoy talking politics. And I wasn't sure that if it became my job, I would actually enjoy it so much anymore.
Mm.
So that was where my reservations came from. What was the other part of the question, sorry?
I guess, was there anything about council specifically that, you know, you thought this is a role that will allow me to do what I want to do? Or was that part of the motivation?
Yeah, so two things. I guess one is that it's a stepping stone. You know, I didn't study public policy. I have never worked in the public sector before, unless you count defense. And so I didn't really think of myself as somebody who would have the skills to do that kind of thing. You know, I studied music and languages. You know, I come from quite an artistic background. And so that made me quite apprehensive. But what I loved about the idea of council was that it was so material. You know, it's so immediately relevant to so many people's lives.
Mm.
Changes and policies that we set in motion have the potential to house people and to feed people and to, you know, create an accessible mode of living for potentially hundreds of thousands. And that idea is very seductive. I found it very seductive. Mm. You know, we're quite privileged in council in the sense that we don't have to debate, you know, cannabis reform or abortion or same-sex marriage. You know, we don't have to do the ideological stuff.
Yep.
None of that makes it to our table. You know, we're concerned about roads, rates, and rubbish.
That's such an interesting way of putting it. I really like that.
Yeah, and so as someone who's always been very, like, materially minded, that was one thing that attracted me to it. Obviously, I have a little bit of a performance streak. I've always loved being on stage. I've always liked public speaking, and so that side of it is quite fun. Also, obviously, being a Māori ward, there is the opportunity to be somewhat more ideological than perhaps some of my geographic colleagues, because I'm technically and be represented for all Māori in the city, which is quite a large constituency.
Yeah, what a lot of responsibility.
So, yeah, it is. But that was one thing that really attracted me to it.
Yeah, awesome. So just off the cuff, I didn't, you know, say I'd ask you this. This is just related to what you were saying. I know you said you've only been in the role for 3 months or so, but have there been any kind of payoffs or wins that have made you think, this is great?
Like just yesterday, and it's tiny stuff as well, and that's what you have to understand, like relevant to central government and national politics, it's tiny stuff. But just for example, we had a couple of benches unveiled on, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Welly, but
a little
on the corner of Vivian and Cuba Street. It's like sort of central intersection of the city next to Logan Brown. There were a couple of benches that we unveiled, and they were dedicated to a couple of trans icons, Carmen Rupe or Rupe, I'm not sure how to say that name, unfortunately. And name is Wee Tuki as well. And they were a classic example of like hostile anti-homeless architecture. You know, they had these big spikes on the end so that, you know, rough sleepers couldn't use them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I saw that and I was like, bro, like, come on. You know, we're dedicating these two benches to two like LGBT icons who did experience homelessness themselves.
Mm.
And we're putting homeless spikes on it. Like, come on. And so I head up the team and I just asked them flat out, like, yo, is this something that we do as a city? Do we deliberately engage in hostile architecture? And they kind of gave me a few answers, but eventually they were like, yeah, actually, you know, it is part of our strategy that we pick and choose where we put like accessible benches. And I was like, oh, that's pretty rough. That's pretty messed up. But following that phone call, the head city planner, who is really awesome, just got on the phone with some of her, I was going to say lackeys, but that's not very nice, some of her staff.
Yeah.
And they're going to get rid of them. So
amazing.
That was awesome. You know, like, and this is just top of mind to me because it happened literally about 24 hours ago. And I was just over the moon. Like, all it took was one phone call. I was on a date, actually, and I just walked past them. And I said to my companion, I was like, that's pretty messed up. And she agreed with me.
Yeah.
And I called up that evening and it just got fixed. So, you know, that was like, I don't know, it's a tiny thing in the scheme of things. But, you know, if a couple of people get to, you know, who are having a rough time, get to sleep on the bench, you know, awesome. So there's that. But there have been some like policy wins as well. You know, we're launching our zero waste strategy. We're promoting e-bikes in the city. We're making progress on cycle lanes. A lot of climate response stuff that's happened so far. And we've found a solution to our community housing. It's not my dream solution. I don't like it very much, but it's going to improve the lives of a lot of people and allow them to access some rent subsidies that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to access. So there have been some wins so far.
Yeah, definitely. I really think that was a great example as well of how directly you can affect things.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right? Yeah, excellent. So you mentioned earlier that you were elected in Te Whanganui Atara, the Māori ward. So that's newly or recently established, isn't it? Can you tell me about, you know, what you know, hopefully, well, likely more than I do, about how that came to be established and what a sort of what it means to have Māori wards? And probably a lot of people would have heard about Māori wards just because of people complaining about them in the media. So I wondered if you could maybe tell me, you know, what is a Māori ward? Specifically, how did Te Whanganui Atara come about? And have you encountered any sort of people who are resistant to Māori wards? And what do you say to them?
So for those who are unfamiliar with how the Māori ward works, it essentially replaces your vote for a geographic council. So if you are Māori and if you are on the Māori electoral roll, the same one that we use for general elections, you know, there are like seven Māori seats up and down the country in Parliament, and you have to be on the Māori roll to vote for those. It's the same deal. So instead of voting for whoever is your local person in your area, you vote for a citywide Māori representative. There is some debate about whether that's an equitable way for that process to occur, because you do effectively lose out on making a choice about your local representative. You know, but of course the counter argument is otherwise, if you are allowed to vote for a Māori representative and a local representative, then it's sort of one person, two votes goes the argument, which I don't agree with, but that's, you know, the other side of it. But anyway, so that's how the Māori would work. And so there in Wellington, I think we have about like 10 or 11% of the population is Māori, of which I think maybe 7% are on the Māori roll. The rest are just on the general roll. Don't quote me on those numbers. I'll have to double check. And of those, I think about 42, 45% voted. And so it's been interesting. The seat came about largely through the work of the previous council. And I'll give a shout out to Fleur Fitzsimmons, Dr. Jenny Condy, Rebecca Matthews, and Tam Paul, who all kind of led that mahi in the previous council. And it was part of the Pākehere agreement that the Wellington City Council has signed with our mana whenua partners, the two local iwi of Wellington are Ngāti Toa Rangatira, from whom I hail, and then Taranaki Whānui, which is a confederation of originally Taranaki-based tribes who migrated down in the 1820s with Ngāti Toa. And between the two of them, they share mana whenua status for the region. And so they have a pretty all-encompassing strategy document that was signed with the Wellington City Council, and as part of it, the establishment of a Māori ward was guaranteed. And so that was where that came from. I'm very grateful to those people for basically getting me a job. And yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of, to be frank, rubbish about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of resistance. People still seem to cling to that notion of special treatment, which is kind of interesting because if anything, it's a disadvantage being on the Māori roll because now you kind of have fewer options than someone on the general roll, but whatever. You know, for me, it's a sovereignty issue. You know, Tiriti is an agreement between two sovereign nations who have agreed effectively to govern their own people and maintain their rangatiratanga over their own.
Yeah.
And, you know, a Māori seat, although it is only one, is a manifestation of that within a settler colonial project that we call New Zealand. So it's good enough for our current paradigm, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that it is an accurate manifestation of the aspirations of Tiriti or Waitangi by any measure.
Yep. I think people are just resistant to Māori representation
generally,
unfortunately.
It's the same nonsense we've been hearing about the Māori since they were established in the whenever. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well put.
Yeah.
Cool. So we're kind of getting a good sense of it, but maybe you could now, I'm going to ask you to lay your cards out there and just tell me about your politics. Like, do you identify with any particular kind of politics? What are the things that you care really deeply about? And then maybe we could talk just after that. That's quite a big question in itself, but how you bring those into your role as a councillor, what do you want to achieve, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess in polite company, if we're doing the labels thing, which let's just love to do.
You don't have to, but...
we can do the labels thing. In polite company, I'll refer to myself as a progressive. That's kind of like a palatable term for liberal electioneering in the West, yeah. And so that's the one that I use. But, you know, amongst my mates, and in fact, to anyone, I'm not trying to hide this whatsoever. Like, I'm pretty clear that I believe in Indigenous socialism and Marxist-Leninism as a tool that many people and groups across the world have used to great success. And I have no reason to disbelieve that it could work in Aotearoa. I guess the unique element of that ideology can, when compared to traditional socialism, is there is that sovereignty element. You know, there is communal ownership of means of production and there is an equitable flat society, but there is an extra element, which is that those with whakapapa govern their own affairs in their own traditional way. And there are cases where it breaks from traditional doctrine based on tikanga. And, you know, where the tensions in that exist is something that will need to be fleshed out by scholarship, which I'm not brave enough for. But I would say that, yeah, if we're picking labels, that's the idea that I'm most closely ascribed to. But what that means in a practical sense is that I'm absolutely committed to the Tiriti or Waitangi. My dream country would be a literal manifestation of the Tiriti or Waitangi. You know, I want to walk down the street and see skyscrapers shaped like Whareanui. You know, I want to cross the crossing and go from hearing English to hearing Māori, you know, spoken at the supermarket.
Yeah.
I want to be a country where there are two houses of parliament, you know. where we have Te Kahu Iaraki and, you know, the government of, I guess, the New Zealand Republic, or if we have to keep the monarchy, then, you know, under His Majesty. Then, in a more practical sense, I'm very keen on ideas like universal public housing, universal needs guarantee. I'm very keen on work cooperatives and progressive taxation, wealth taxes. I'm very keen on land value taxes as well, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting and often like bipartisan idea that gets thrown around in various like urbanist left circles. I agree with respect to city design and urban reform. I do ascribe to, I guess, urbanism quite a lot. I think we need density and green density to house people. You know, there's always that, what's that joke about? The only thing more depressing than Soviet architecture is homelessness.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah. And so, yes, you know, skyscrapers might not be everyone's cup of tea, but we have to put people somewhere.
Yep.
You know, we are an island surrounded by ocean, but land is not an unlimited resource.
Yep.
And we're a city on a harbour that's surrounded by hills. Like, there's not, we don't have a lot of places to go. And in terms of people who want low rates, like, best way to keep your rates low is to cut urban sprawl and single-story dwellings and instead focus on centralized density along which we can deliver services cheaply and effectively. On top of that, you know, big fan of free public transport. Still trying to convince my mates on the regional council of that one, but that's all good. And I'm also very keen on mutual aid and community self-defense. I've made it quite publicly known that I'm not a great fan of the police force, which people find interesting given my military. But
you're not the first person that I've interviewed who has a sort of background in the army who is very critical of police. So, you know, it's maybe not as weird as you think.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, army faces, well, defence faces outwards, police faces inwards, you know what I mean?
Yep.
As a soldier, I don't have any authority over a New Zealand citizen whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? I exist to serve a New Zealand system citizen, whereas a policeman exists to dominate a New Zealand citizen and protect the interests of private property and capital. You know, you have to look at any land protest. Who's there? It's not the Defence Force.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the cops.
Exactly.
Protecting private interests. And so, yeah, that is an interesting thing, but I'm really keen on, you know, community self-defence and the rights of Indigenous, queer and oppressed people to arm themselves as well, which is quite an interesting opinion to share in various progressive circles.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I could rant on about my hot takes on the universe, but I guess those are the big ones.
Yeah. No, that's very comprehensive. And I really like, I think that sort of Indigenous socialism and what that would actually look like in Aotearoa is a conversation that people are very scared to have, you know, particularly Tauihi socialists are very kind of either subscribe to like, no, you know, often conflate sovereignty and nationalism.
Well, so here's the thing. I don't, you know, it's a funny one because nationalism is kind of like a dirty word on the list, but, you know, I probably hold a number of views that could not incorrectly described as Māori nationalism. You know, I do think we are a sovereign nation. Yes, I do think we should have our own government and govern our own affairs. You know, yes, I do think we should share our language and maintain our kakapapa, you know what I mean? So I guess maybe technically on paper, those might be nationalist beliefs.
But I mean, like anti-colonial nationalism has been so important for, you know, across the world. And I'm thinking in like Central and South America and, you know, in Africa and stuff as well. So that's a part of socialism, a part of the tradition that sometimes I think people don't want to recognise too much, but it's, you know.
It is. And unfortunately, I think a large part of it is because the label national socialism is already taken. So we can't call it that, unfortunately. But yeah.
Awesome. So I guess you've talked about some of the cool things about working in local government and about that sort of direct effect that you can have on the state of, you know, people's lives, however many people that might be, could be a few, could be quite a few. But is there anything sort of that you find challenging or limiting about local government? Is there anything just in the first 3 months that you've been surprised by?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. How little control we have.
Mm.
Something that I'm learning the longer I spend in government is that we are living in a zombie system filled with zombie institutions. God forbid, if every one of our elected members in local government across the entire country were to drop dead of a heart attack tomorrow, and for whatever reason we decided not to replace them, every metropolitan area could run for 10 years with no governance.
Wow.
Probably longer. You know, it's quite frightening the degree of stability that we've created. Mm. And, you know, from the perspective of the ancient world, which was politically extremely unstable, you know, civilizations would regularly collapse with the death of a single monarch.
Yeah.
The thing that makes certainly capitalism so unnerving is that the institutions it creates are self-perpetuating.
Mm.
You know, I can affect very little compared to what I thought I could when I was on the campaign trail. You know, we are herded by our officers are staff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are constrained by legislation, which is in turn constrained by its own legislation, which is in turn subject to parliament, who are constrained in what they can do by standing orders and precedent and the courts, which are in turn constrained by, you know, centuries of common law, which have come from the UK. So we exist in a very inelastic framework for creating change, which is what makes it so frustrating for very left-wing people, like I guess myself and Tamitha Paul, to exist in these environments, because I have, I'm not going to call them authoritarian tendencies, but definitely hands-on tendencies. You know, I want
I've described myself in a similar way before, so at least you're
yeah. Well, I want to have my hands on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
I want to have my hands on. I don't like the feeling that I'm being shepherded when I have a mandate from the citizens of Wellington to be where I am.
Yeah.
And I find that very difficult. And I think a number of my colleagues on both sides of the political divide, I say both like it's not only bimodal, but whatever, on sort of the NIMBY versus YIMBY side of the table, if you like, I think a lot of people feel that way. And I would imagine many parliamentarians feel that way as well. So I think that to me is definitely the most unnerving element of working in government, the fact that I probably don't need to be there and the system would continue to function exactly how it's functioned for 100 years.
Hmm. So I guess you just have to identify those moments where you can, throw a bit of a spanner in the works or try and...
Yeah.
Interesting. So yeah. I wondered if you could tell me, what have people been like about you're a relatively young person and you've talked about your commitment to Te Tiriti. Has that gone down well with, you know, other councillors or people that you work with?
Honestly, it's been pretty good. Yeah. You know, when I first entered the campaign trail, I prepared a number of responses when people I felt would inevitably say, "Oh, you're too young. You have no governance experience. What are you going to do?" You know, but it literally did not come up. The only time it was even mentioned was in like radio interviews where they said, "Oh, how old are you?" And I said, "I'm 22, 23." You know, and they went, "Oh my goodness," you know. But I never heard it from my political opponents. I never heard it from members of the public. It didn't come up. So that was awesome. I think, you know, in Wellington, we're quite used to having politically active youth.
Mm-hmm.
And there are councillors. I mean, Tam was elected when she was like 21 or 22 or something outrageous. I was 20. I happened basically just after my 23rd birthday.
Mm.
And there's also a councillor, Terry O'Neill, who's very young. You know, it has happened.
Yeah.
I happen to be the youngest at the council table at the moment, but I'm by no means the youngest in history.
Mm.
And, you know, there's that fella down in Gore who's like, what, like 18 and he's the mayor? You know what I mean? So I think we're quite comfortable with youth being in local government because it is so practical. You know, I think when it comes to those big ideological questions, people have something of a bias for age and life experience, which is not an unreasonable position, to be honest with you. Like, I come from a culture, obviously, where our elders and their wisdom is really respected. So that's a feeling I can relate to and understand. So that never came up. In terms of statistics, definitely got some pushback on that. When I remember I did a Reddit session where I just put myself out there and asked people to say anything, ask me anything, whatever. And I probably received over 100, 150 individual replies. I spent several days answering all of them. And people were not necessarily very respectful to the radical vision that I laid out to you just earlier. I pretty much said the same thing. You know, I said, you know, I don't want co-governance. I want Indigenous sovereignty. I want Māori to own land and own assets. You know, own is kind of a dirty word as well, actually. Own is sort of like a European construct. I guess possess or occupy would might be a better term. But anyway, I said, well, I want us to return land, water, and assets to the original inhabitants of this land. If I had my way, Māori would own half the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 50-50, just like the treaty says. So that was quite shocking for a lot of people. But fortunately for me, the Wellington is pretty white, and those Māori who are here tend to be like the middle manager, lanyard wielding, university educated, you know, half caste brown that would find that kind of idea attractive. And yeah, evidently that worked out for me. So
yeah.
I got pretty lucky in that regard, but I happen to have the right message for the right constituency.
Yeah. So on that note, what have you had positive feedback from, you know, the people who would have been voting for you from your constituents?
Yes. Mm. Yes. And I've always been quite bad at taking praise. You know, when I fail, I feel crushed and I'm pretty dark for a couple of days. But when I succeed, and this is just at anything, but when I succeed, I'm relieved. You know, I find it very hard to feel pride or joy in things. You know, and when I was elected, I was like, I probably had like 30 minutes maybe of like happiness. And then after that, I was like, oh, sweet, all good. You know, phew, that didn't turn out badly. And so whenever I receive positive comments from people, you know, and I just see like the faith that some people seem to have in me, I kind of, I don't know, I find it quite hard to process. I don't really know what to make of it. You know, I can't really believe it. And that's something that I'm still working on. But I've been like that my whole life, and I'm not sure that will ever change. But, you know, I just have to remind myself in my own terms, even if I really can't really make this idea connect emotionally, that, you know, there are literally thousands of people relying on me to do the right thing. And it is quite a responsibility because I'm just some dude from Kapiti. So
we're all just some dude, really. So
we all are just some dude. That's just how it is. We are just some dude.
Yep. Oh, that's awesome. I did sort of indicate that I wanted to ask you a bit about the relationship between, say, socialism and tino rangatiratanga, but I think you've been there already. Did you want to say anything more about that, or maybe some listeners might not be familiar with the concept of tino rangatiratanga? So maybe
sure.
Just give us your perspective.
Of course. So tino rangatiratanga in the traditional sense is translated as absolute sovereignty. And in the Tiriti, it says that Māori are, in the Māori translation, so there is a, for those of people who might not be aware of this, there is a significant difference between the English version and the Māori version, mainly centered around the idea of sovereignty and governorship. English version says that Māori cede sovereignty to Her Majesty the Queen. Māori version says that Māori maintain sovereignty and cede governorship to the Queen. And there's also a great deal of historical context that I've been on a journey learning recently about why the treaty was created. It was largely in response to the settler capitalist project of the New Zealand Company, who were driving settlements sort of in the top of the south, bottom of the North Island, and the British colonial administration kind of saw that they were about to, you know, they were about to see a commercial city-state emerge in the South Pacific that was not necessarily beholden to the English crown. And they realized they had to move very quickly and create a colonial entity before it became like a market territory.
Mm.
You know, the Wakefield brothers were deadly quick in their acquisition, often predatory acquisition of land here, particularly in Tongariro Aotearoa. You know, we have, aside from maybe Nelson, we have maybe the most comprehensive colonial history in terms of the commercial side of things, as opposed to Auckland, which was chosen by Hobson to be the seat of government because of its distance from Te Whanganui Ātara and the settler capitalist project that was going on down there under the Wakefields of the New Zealand Company. So that was the setting in which Te Tiriti was originally created. And Māori were guaranteed that to maintain their rangatiratanga, and that is a idea, that is a promise that Māori have not forgotten.
Mm.
You know, the Tiriti guarantees that we remain a sovereign people. And as a sovereign people, we are entitled to our own government, our own mode of living, our own system of relations to one another, our own economy, our own culture, our own language, and everything else that you would see if you went to, I don't know, Peru, or if you went to Barbados. Both of those countries do have a colonial history, but just ignoring that. Okay, let's go with France instead. You know, they speak a different language, they use their own political system, they have their own history, Yep. They're sovereign. You know what I mean? And that is something that Māori should be as well. The unique thing is that we have to exist as an occupied nation. Mm. You know, we're a sovereign people without territory, which is one of the unique contradictions of colonialism in the Western sense, and is faced by many other groups worldwide. You know, there are ways that it manifests differently. For example, Indigenous people of the United States have reservations, territories over which they actually do hold some degree of sovereignty. First Nations people in Canada, same thing. I spent a lot of time on the west coast of Canada, with a very strong Coast Salish culture, and I lived for some short time there at reservation. You know, the Aboriginal people of Australia have probably even less sovereignty than we do. Yeah. You know, we have enshrined rights to constitutional representation, they don't. But anyway, all of these things are expressions of te mana rangatiratanga, of absolute sovereignty. And when we talk about that with regard to socialism, people often feel there's a contradiction because socialism is international. You know, it doesn't recognize borders traditionally. It views all states as the providence of workers and nothing else, with no distinction made based on religion, ethnicity, caste, etc. I guess the relationship between socialism and te mana rangatiratanga is not necessarily one of contradiction, but it's unorthodox. Mm. One of my personal heroes is Thomas Sankara, who was a leader of Burkina Faso, which was previously named French Upper Volta, as a French colony in Africa, and he used the tools of Marxism to pretty much destroy the colonial project that had been set up in his lands, and he successfully created a socialist workers' state whilst maintaining some vestiges of traditional indigenous life for his people. And he was possibly one of the most successful indigenous socialists in history. I guess the Zapatistas as well were another example of indigenous socialism. There are plenty of examples around the world, but he comes to mind purely because of the way in which he maintained his indigenous traditions. He did disempower some hereditary chiefs, which was a call that he had to make, and you know, I wasn't there, so I'm not going to diss him for it. But for me, what indigenous socialism in Aotearoa looks like is a sovereign assembly of either elected or whakapapa-based ariki chiefs, who are elected to some kind of legislative body, who have sovereignty over their own territory and work in cooperation with, you know, a general republic or a, you know, constitutional monarchy in tandem. You know, and to be honest, the mode of production in pre-colonial Aotearoa could not incorrectly be described as a sort of socialism.
Well, yeah.
Marx references this when he talks about primitive socialism.
That's right.
You know, we're going to ignore the linguistic implications.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was European and it was the 1800s. I forgive him. It's all good. but, you know, so a return to, a 21st century futurist style of tikanga-based living with an economic system resembling socialism would be my dream for this country. What the Pākehā do is up to them, you know.
Yeah.
they're also a sovereignty, you know. It's not just us. They're sovereign too. They can they can choose their own. If they don't choose socialism, that's a shame. But, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of sad part of it all is oftentimes we forget that there are two parties in the treaty, you know. We've got our own whole sort of house to attend to, you know. It's interesting.
And to be honest, it's a shame more Whakaa New Zealanders don't acknowledge that. You know, there's a lot of the older generation have this weird, like, hangover love affair with the British Crown and still feel like their allegiance to His Majesty. You know, it's very odd to me that we kind of, you know, if you just remove Te Ao Māori entirely, what's New Zealand culture? Like pies and number eight wire and stubbies?
Yeah.
That's pretty pathetic, man.
Yeah, I think we could do better.
Yeah, we're a country without an identity, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Cool. This has been such an amazing conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I think we'll start to wrap things up now, but maybe can I ask you, what do you think, do you have any recommendations for what socialists could do? Maybe it's stuff they could read, people they should check out, or projects they should get involved with to kind of support, you know, your vision of Aotearoa?
Yep. Meet your neighbours, learn first aid, learn to speak Māori. Honestly, if everyone in the country did those three things, I think we'd be fine.
That's I really like learn first aid. It's good.
Well, seriously, you know, we need to build dual power. We need mutual defence and aid networks within our communities that aren't reliant on capitalist institutions. And if you do all that through a tikanga Māori lens, you're halfway there already.
Cool. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
No. Sorry, I probably talked to you for the last 45 minutes. I'm a bit of a yarner, as you can probably tell.
I've really enjoyed this conversation. Honestly, it's been really fun and really interesting to me. And yeah, just it's a real pleasure for me to talk to you. So I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, likewise.
Did you manage to think about a song that you would like me to play?
So it's called Pera Yang Atai O Homipaka. And the reason I love it, it's a mōpiopia or a waiata that was composed by my ancestor, Te Rau Paraha, whom I referenced in my opening pepeha. He was the paramount chief of Ngāti Toa in the 1810s, 1820s, 1830s. And then in the kickoff of the land wars, and he was chased out of Kawhia, which is our traditional land up north, and he led the entire iwi on a migration down, basically from like the Kaipara Harbour, like Hamilton, basically all the way down to Wellington on foot, over the course of like maybe just a year or two. Stopped off in Taranaki, hung out there for a bit, grabbed the boys, came down. But when he was leaving, this was in 1821, by the way. When he was leaving his ancestral home of Kawhia, there's a very beautiful beach called Honipaka. Up there, you can still go there. I've never been, but I'm going to go. And he looked upon it for the last time in his life, and he was so overcome with emotion that he composed this song.
Tira yanga tayo honipaka kawe kwe yawe. Kamanga tina kuya kataka we Nara mai o te motu E tu noa mai ra koe I aha we Nā kuya ra koe I wai hoi taku whenua I ti Te roko hanga te taranga Yatawa Kamihi mama wau ki te iwi raia Moe no mai te moe ngaroa Ka pari ai te tai piki tu piki rere piki tā kina mai rā Te kawe au e te tere
That was Tira Ianga Tai o Honipaka, and my guest counsellor Nico Winera selected that waiata for you. Kia ora, Nico. I look forward to crossing paths again. Right now, I have a couple of sources to review. So Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, is a 2013 work by Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley, who specialises in issues of racism and racial justice in American law. In Dog Whistle Politics, Haney-Lopez tracks the historical deployment of thinly veiled racism by both the Republican and Democratic parties since the abolition of slavery in the 1860s. And more than that, Haney-Lopez argues that the specific goal of quote-unquote dog whistle politics has been to erode the public programs and regulations associated with the New Deal. Haney-Lopez puts it this way. Beyond aiming to win votes, the goal of dog whistle politics is often to generate support for policies that favour society's wealthiest. dog whistle appeals generate middle-class enthusiasm for political candidates who promise to crack down on crime, curb undocumented immigration, and protect the heartland against Islamic infiltration, but ultimately vote to slash taxes for the rich, give corporations regulatory control over industry and financial markets, and aggressively curtail social services. As with many others I've reviewed, dog whistle politics is hardly socialist. In fact, Haney Lopez has a lot of advice for the Democratic Party, and his wish seems to be the return to an idealised liberal democratic capitalism before the extremes of neoliberalism. Still, dog whistle politics names and details some of the origins of a political rhetoric and a tactic that is widespread. For one need only think of certain references to bottom feeders and bad neighbours in state houses. For its relevance and relative ease of access, I give dog whistle politics 3.5 red stars. Next up, it's the Tāringa podcast, produced by Te Wānanga or Aotearoa. Hosted by Te Puaheri Snowden, Erica Sinclair and Paraoni Gloing, the Tāringa podcast is fun, light-hearted, and it encourages listeners to engage with te reo and tikanga Māori. Each episode is delivered both in te reo Māori and English, and each episode also has a particular theme, for example, iwi o te wiki, tikanga 101, or te matatini 2023. The Tāringa podcast has over 270 episodes, and those episodes are available via your preferred podcast provider. I'm very new to the podcast, but for now, I give it 4 red stars. Okay, so I have another song for you now. This time, it's the 1988 song, E Tū, by Apa Hut Posse. Enjoy.
Kāranga, rangatahi, whakarongo, whakarongo. We're nā tamatoa, so we must like te ahi. Don't get led astray by Babylon. Kia mō ki tō Māori. There's a lot of people who think they're tough today, but Jesus lights it over, how would have blown them away. To whom he ki, he had spreads to disgust by kai down the flag and call ha. Yo, paki ko Māori in a mata whero. So te kōti exacted it in a slaughter. It's a Māori battalion in a World War II. Staunch on the battlefield and had many clues. Like Moana, Ngāti Mu from Hill 209. Victoria Cross, so true, so strong. It's a Māori, was a fierce warrior. Strike fear in the hearts of Babylon soldier. Yeah, it's true, that's why I'm talking to you. Kia kaha, 2-1-2-2. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Yes, the man who tried to kill him, what, Fontaine Ski. But he became a victim of his own folly. Cause team took a word of him to smash, you see. Guerrilla warfare, ha, Māori. The British tried to take it apart, they thought it'd be a victory. Kakawiki had fooled the enemy. The British raided the pie, yeah, but they got shot down. Cause Kawiri had a plan, and it was sound. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Te Rangi Hayata believes in holding the land against the foe, yo, the British man. To him that's essential to the manner of the chief. In the hut, there was some hardcore feats. In 1846, in the Hutt Valley, I see fighting broke out between the British and the Māori. And more than one settler on disputed land was killed when the Māori fought the British plan. Cause white rule and justice go hand in hand. So against that is where we stand. Yo, don't forget those who fought before. Our struggle continues more and more. Yeah, it's a struggle, it's a struggle. System's got us in a muddle. So strive to get out of this puddle. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Air 2, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Say it loud. Yo.
stand tall, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud. Air two, stand proud. Kia kaha, say it loud.
That was It Too by Upper Hutt Posse, and that's about it for another month. I have just a couple of events to mention before I sign off. Next Wednesday, the 8th of March, is International Women's Day, and I'm excited to say that this year, the CSS is doing something a little different. A group of quiz mistresses, of which I am one, have put their brains together to bring to life the first ever CSS International Women's Day quiz night, featuring five rounds that span topics of history and politics, science, mythology, music, film, and more. You can register a team of 2 to 6 people, or you can register as an individual and we'll team you up. And in order to do that, just search the CSS on Facebook and you'll find a link to the event. Doors are 6:30 for a 7 p.m. start, and the venue is Space Academy. For more information, see that CSS Facebook page or send an email to CanterburySocialistSociety@gmail.com. If you're based in the capital, our comrades at the Wellington Socialist Society are also hosting an International Women's Day event. This one is scheduled for Tuesday, the 7th of March, and it features Labour historian Sybil Locke on the topic of communist women's activism in Aotearoa New Zealand. The event starts at 6 p.m. at Bedlam and Squalor, and I'm looking forward to tuning into the live stream. Remember that you can head to socialistsocieties.org.nz to learn more about the CSS, the WSS, or the New Zealand Federation of Socialist Societies, the NZFSS. That's it from me. So until next time, ka kite anō.
Thank you for listening. And if you want to find out more, you can find us on Facebook as the Canterbury Socialist Society or visit our website at www.canterburysocialistsociety.org.nz. Thank you, and until next time, take care.